Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Washington Roundtable. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. After Senate passage and President Biden's signature, $95 billion in aid will be heading to Ukraine, Israel, and to improve U.S. and allied Indo-Pacific capabilities. But the amount might not be enough to help Kyiv win. That said, Washington did approve the transfer of longer-range ATACMS missiles that have proven devastating against Russian targets. President Macron makes a case for Europe to reduce reliance on America and China. The stunning extent of Russian and Chinese infiltration of the European Parliament and German politics is revealed. Secretary of State Antony Blinken becomes the latest U.S. official to visit Beijing to urge cooperation as Chinese officials make clear to Washington again that it has to choose cooperation on its terms or confrontation. America and the Philippines hold military drills, and Israel strikes Iran as it steps up operations in Gaza. This as the United States and its allies try to build a causeway off Gaza to bring aid to the Strip humanitarian workers say is absolutely critical to prevent famine. Joining us today to discuss all this and more are Dr. Patrick Cronin, the Asia-Pacific Security Chair at the Hudson Institute Think Tank, Michael Herson, the President of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense and aerospace lobbying firms, former Pentagon Europe Chief Jim Townsend, who is now with the Center for a New American Security and a co-host of the Brussels Sprouts podcast, a must for anybody interested in the Transatlantic Alliance, especially this on the alliance's 75th anniversary, and former Pentagon comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who counts the Center for Strategic and International Studies among his many affiliations. Everybody, great to have you back on the program. Hope everybody had a happy Passover and continuing holidays. Dov, thanks very much for joining us from vacation. And before we get started, the Defense and Aerospace Report and his family of publications is brought to you by HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Bell, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. Once again, everybody, welcome. Great to have everybody together. Michael, you know, every week is a busy week, even if you know, the House is on a session and it's only the Senate that's in town. The Senate passed the supplemental with a higher than expected margin, which was very, very welcome. After President Biden's signature, aid is going to start arriving in Ukraine. And indeed, everybody has said it should arrive, you know, as quickly as possible because the Ukrainians really need it. And was also the revelation that in February, and I believe the administration deserves credit for this, finally shipping longer range ATACMS missiles to Ukraine that Kyiv has already used several times with apparently impressive results. But Speaker Johnson is braving a firestorm from his party for doing his job. We could say 6 months later than needed, but still did his job and exhibited political courage to do that. First, bring us up to speed on Johnson's future and the aftermath of what was doing the right thing, a signal the whole world has breathed a sigh of relief over.
Right. Okay, well, let's start with what happened after we finished taping on Friday, right? Because on Saturday is when the House passed these four individual bills that got rolled up into one bill and sent to the Senate as the emergency supplemental. So the Ukraine aid bill passed 311 to 112. 210 Democrats voted for it. 101 Republicans voted for it. So many more Democrats than Republicans. 112 Republicans opposed. And I think what's noteworthy is 17 members of the House Armed Services Committee, who are Republicans, voted against funding Ukraine out of 31. So more than half the committee. In addition, Congressman Molinar, who is now going to be taking over from Mike Gallagher as the new chair of the China Committee, voted against the Ukraine supplemental package, when we know that that Ukraine and China are linked. And then also Brian Mast voted against it. I mentioned Mast only because Mast is somebody who's thinking about running for chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee at some point. So then the Israel package passed 366-58. Fewer Democrats voted for it, but still a large number, 173 Democrats, 193 Republicans in favor. So more Republicans than Democrats. The Indo-Pacific package passed overwhelmingly 385 to 34. Then also that sidecar legislation we talked about that had the lend-lease for Ukraine, the Repo Act, sanctions against Russia and China, ban on tic-tac, also passed overwhelmingly 360 to 58. It's noteworthy that, you know, the members of the Chaos Caucus, like Congressman Good, Congressman Massey, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and others voted against all four pieces of that legislation. Now, as you mentioned, the Senate did stay in during the early part of the recess, and late Tuesday night, the Senate overwhelmingly passed this this bill. And it was kind of a surprise, too, because a lot of people felt that, you know, when the bill passed back in February, the Senate bill passed with 70 votes. And a lot of people didn't think they could get 70 votes again. They actually got 79 votes this time. 31 Republicans voted for this bill compared to just 22 who voted for it back in February. And then, of course, Biden signed the package Wednesday. And since this equipment was pre-positioned, within hours, equipment started to flow. So, look, since the vote, there's been, you know, some fighting, and fighting continues among the Republicans. You know, Thomas Massey, who's now said he will support a motion to vacate, spent a lot of the weekend after the bill's passed lashing out at his colleagues. Congressman Tony Gonzalez down in Texas, who has a tough primary, referred to the Massey wing of the party as real scumbags on one of the Sunday shows. Lindsey Graham came out, you know, criticizing J.D. Vance. As you know, J.D. Vance, senator from Ohio, has been very critical of funding Ukraine, and even made some theater when he walked out of Zelensky's brief when Zelensky was here earlier this year. But Graham said to him, quit talking about things you don't know anything about. So it's definitely tensions are running high. And, you know, we talk about Speaker Johnson. So, you know, the Freedom Caucus decided to tweet after the bill's passed, you know, forget the Hastert rule. And it's funny they refer to the Hastert rule. I mean, remember, Denny Hastert was a convicted pedophile, ended up serving time in prison, and they still want to refer to the Hastert rule. But, you know, they say, we forget about that rule under Speaker Johnson. Now, the Johnson rule, where the governing principle by which a Republican Speaker of the House repeatedly advances major legislation with more support from Democrats than his own party. And that's just total nonsense, because all four of these bills, three out of the four, passed with more Republican votes than Democratic votes. It's just the Ukraine bill. And I will say, I did talk to some of the Republicans that voted against the Ukraine bill. I don't excuse their vote, but a lot of them do support aid to Ukraine. They were just fearful of going back home and answering their constituents after spinning this whole tale for months that we were not going to support Ukraine aid and protect their border unless we protected our border first. Especially a lot of the members from Texas felt they couldn't go home and do that.
But that's political cowardice. They had a measure that they could have voted for that would have improved security on the border. They decided they didn't want that because the former president said, I don't want to deliver this president a win in an election year. That's it. They had an answer. It was their fantasy legislation.
Yes, I agree 100%, right? That they were setting themselves up for failure on that narrative. And this apples and oranges anyway. Look, you know, Johnson, I think, is getting a lot of kudos from both sides of the aisle, frankly. And Democrats are making it clear that removing Johnson, actually Jared Moskowitz, a Democrat from Florida, said removing Johnson would only embolden China, would only embolden Russia, and would only embolden Iran. So I think that his position is pretty safe. And, you know, I think it remains to be seen whether there is a motion to vacate or not. And I think that the Marjorie Taylor Greene and Massey and others like the negative attention they get and the question of whether they're going to do it or not. But Johnson did put his career on the line to get this done. And I think you really got to take a step back and look at Johnson's speakership so far. I mean, he has kept the government open by passing CRs while we negotiated the budget deals. He did get all 12 appropriations bills passed. I mean, it did take 6 months under CR, but he did get everything passed, including defense. He did get FISA reauthorized despite opposition from Trump and the far right. He is sending billions of dollars to Ukraine, Israel, and the Indo-Pacific. So I think, you know, already his speakership is more consequential than that of Speaker McCarthy. And he did work hard with Trump to get him not to oppose this package. And he got other GOP lawmakers as well. There were former cabinet officials, retired military officers, all trying to get Trump not to come out against Ukraine. And Trump actually defended Johnson after the vote. So did Newt Gingrich and other people on the far right. And Zelensky graciously on Thursday spoke with Speaker Johnson, expressing his gratitude for his leadership that ensured true bipartisan cooperation, which we also saw on the Senate side as well. I mean, McConnell, I think, deserves a great deal of credit for locking arms with Schumer over an 8-month saga to get this done. And together, the two of them together beat the right wing on this to fund Ukraine and move forward on a package that didn't include any border security. So I know it took more time than we wanted to take, but I wouldn't lay all that blame at the Republicans' feet. I don't approve of how long this took and how long that, but, you know, we've talked about this before, right? You know, Zelensky gave an address to a joint session of Congress back in December of 22. And everybody was very hot and very rah-rah Ukraine. And when the Republicans took over in January, within a month, Ken Calvert, the chair of Defense Appropriations, asked for the Ukraine supplemental to be sent. Republicans were asking for that supplemental in February of 23. It was not sent to the Hill until August of 23, when the dynamics, the calendar and the politics had changed dramatically, right? And the administration was very late to the game getting involved in what could have been some bipartisan border legislation last calendar year. And the clock ran out on that. So it was an ugly process, but I give credit to both sides for getting this done.
I think there is both ample criticism that can be made and ample kudos given. And at the end of the day, it's about leadership, and the speaker is exhibiting it. And ultimately, it's about the nation doing the right thing one way or another, election year or not. Frankly, yeah, they're to legislate. We have a huge slate of issues to discuss. So really quickly, give us your sense. I mean, hearings have started. I know you don't pay attention much to hearings, but what is the arc now of the 25 budget cycle? Where is it going? And what do we know is going to happen and is not going to happen over the coming months, right? Because we're getting into prime political season here. Shortly.
Exactly. What we know is going to happen is that we're going to end up with a CR at the end of the fiscal year, right? But in the interim,
didn't see that coming.
So, but what we do see, though, is the process well underway. Now, we've talked before about Mike Rogers, who chairs the House Armed Services Committee, Senator Wicker, who's the ranking Republican on the Senate Armed Services Committee, both wanting to set the NDAA top line numbers above the budget caps. But now we see Senate appropriators saying the same thing. You know, again, the argument saying that the caps imposed by last year's debt limit deal are falling short of the funding needed for a military. It's got problems with recruiting, problems with industrial base, acquisition, ship maintenance problems, while the Chinese are planning a 7.2% increase in their defense budget. The chairman of the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, Democrat Senator John Tester, earlier this week raised the possibility of exceeding the current spending limits. And Senator Susan Collins, who's the senior Republican on appropriation, signals an openness to boosting the defense top line. Again, saying that the budget caps does not cover inflation, much less the growing dangerous threats that we're facing around the globe. And she feels the number is woefully inadequate. I still wouldn't get my hopes up that we end up with a defense number at the end of the day that's higher than the budget caps. But this will get done after the election. So a lot depends on who wins these November elections. So I would say stay tuned. I mean, we've seen it in the past where they added money in conference to these bills. So that's still very possible, although, again, unlikely, one, because I think there's a push to abide by the FRA. But two, remember, we will have to deal with the debt ceiling again in January. So right after the election, there's going to be focus again on the debt ceiling. I think it'll be hard to spend more money right before raising the debt ceiling, but we'll see.
Right. Let me very briefly, before we go to the rest of the team, everybody is breathing a sigh of relief that this funding package has gone through, because it's really existential for Ukraine. But there is a concern that it's actually not enough. Our Sash Tuzza from our Sunday business team, he's an analyst with Agency Partners in London, one of the best in the business, and he maintains, I mean, really, the Ukrainians need north of $100 billion to win. You know, we were discussing just the amount of Patriot weapons, and he said, look, even the amount of Patriots you're producing at more than 500 a year are probably sufficient to defend Kyiv and Odessa without really being able to defend maybe other parts of the country. I know that some might dispute it, but indeed the power station was taken out because the Ukrainians really were husbanding their Patriots, and the two Russian missiles got through, and 1 million people will be out of power for the next few months. Is there any prospect for getting more money out of Congress for Ukraine or more aid? How does that mechanic work, do you think, going forward, especially depending on how things go this summer?
So that's a really good question. And I am not right now optimistic. If you look at the House, for example, you know, even though Johnson did win on foreign aid, Republicans are losing ground with every new class of Republicans that gets elected. Out of the 112 Republican lawmakers who oppose Ukraine funding, 71 of those have been elected since 2018, which is the Trump era. In the Senate, Senator Barrasso, who will be rising up to the number two slot in Senate leadership, is opposed to Ukraine aid. So the new generation that's coming up in the Republican Party, both the House and the Senate, is not favorably disposed toward continuing to fund Ukraine. So I think this will be much harder in the future.
Dove, walk us through your sense, right? Is this a sigh of relief moment? Does this sort of reinforce American leadership around the world? A question that all of us have asked and you've written about repeatedly. And, you know, whether it is enough help to help Ukraine win, or at least keep it from losing. What now, there are a lot of different pieces of this. The Europeans are providing money. The Ukrainians are building up their own defense industrial capacity and able to do more for themselves. I think kudos, and want to get your sense on this also, on the White House decision on ATACMS, because the Russians had always said, you know, ooh, if you, you know, any of your weapons make it into Russia, it's a big problem. The administration seems to be saying you're attacking Ukraine with ballistic missiles. They can respond. Does this send the right signal? Is it enough money? And if not, what else do we need to be doing to help support Ukraine?
Well, it's certainly not enough money. I agree with Michael on that. It depends what you mean by win, quite frankly. It's never been clear what the administration really wanted. And the long-range ATACMS thing is yet again proof of the fact that they could have done this a year ago. I mean, did the Russians only now begin to start hitting inside Ukraine with missiles? It's a ridiculous argument as far as I see it. And it's once again evidence of this hesitation that's led a lot of, and self-deterrence, that's led a lot of Europeans and other supporters of Ukraine to wonder just what exactly is the administration's agenda. They certainly don't want Putin to take all of Ukraine, but do they want Putin to get Crimea? Do they want Putin to get Eastern Ukraine, Luhansk and Donetsk? We just don't know because they're not saying anything. The key, though, is if there's going to be any kind of negotiation, it has to only take place if Putin concludes he cannot defeat Ukraine. That's not winning, but he has to conclude that that's not winning for Ukraine, I should say, but he has to conclude that he cannot defeat Ukraine. I personally believe that whatever happens in this next election, there will be an attempt to have another supplemental before January of 2025. And it'll be very interesting to see if they can get enough votes to make that happen. I think Biden will push for one more, whether he wins or loses. And we just don't know how that'll play out. Because once again, you know, if Trump wins, maybe he'll want to look like some kind of hero. I mean, after all said and done, he seems to have lived with this Ukraine supplemental. And you never know with Trump anyway. And of course, if Biden wins, Biden wins. So let's wait and see on that one. But at a minimum, what we're doing is ensuring that Putin cannot conclude that he will win. And maybe there's more money coming from the Europeans. Do they think everything's wonderful now? Of course not. They know damn well that if Trump becomes president, everything's back up in the air again. And so I would argue that this is more than a Band-Aid, but it's less than a cure. That's how I would look at it.
Artfully said. Jim, you're back from your stint at Sciences Po in sunny Paris, just in time to sweat it out here in Washington. So your timing is perfect, although it's a lovely spring so far. Walk us through whether this amount, and Patrick, want to get your sense as well, right? Is this enough to reassure allies and partners around the world? I mean, what are folks in Europe saying? What are folks, Patrick, in Asia saying? Jim, I would point out, it's fascinating that, you know, days after this was signed, French President Macron returned, as he did in 2017, to the Sorbonne, where he made a major address and basically said, Europe's got to get serious about its security, about technology, and get its act together, including on trade, saying, you know, we can't depend on America because we don't know what's going to happen, right? I mean, obviously, we're discussing the November election and what the outlook is. And oh, by the way, right, some of the smartest security minds in Europe have said, with, you know, as Michael said, like guys like Barroso are going to be in power. This may not be necessarily a Trump-Biden thing. This is a strain that will outlive Donald Trump at this point. The party has been redefined, and it doesn't appear to be pulling itself back from that brink. And Macron is right in saying we're, you know, the rules-based free trade order is being disrupted, not just by China, but by the United States, with now a Democratic administration following a Republican administration on tariffs. you know, all the while Macron underscoring the importance of the United States, right? I mean, this wasn't an anti-American message per se. It was a pro-European one. Walk us through the rhetoric that we're hearing juxtaposed against whether or not anything that happened in Washington is actually reassuring allies after what they look at as 8 or 6 months of damage that was already done to America's reputation.
Vago, you're taking all my talking points.
Oh, sorry.
But no, I actually am still in Paris.
Oh, okay, great.
I leave tomorrow, and in 30 minutes, I have to go to Sciences Po and give a speech about the Macron speech. And up on stage with me will be members of the Quai d'Orsay, the French foreign ministry, who are colleagues and who will be very shocked that I'm not going to talk about my topic, but instead I'm going to talk about the Macron speech. So you're giving me an opportunity to practice a little bit. And so, but not to take everyone's time, just a couple things. One is, I'm sure there's some people in allied capitals and in Kyiv who are breathing a sigh of relief. If they are breathing a sigh of relief, they should all be fired, because we're lucky in a lot of ways that this came through. And I agree with Michael, it was ugly, but we salute those who put their jobs on the line to make it happen. But like you and Dove just talked about, and Mike, can we do it again? Maybe we can and maybe we can't. But you can't fight a war and you can't be in an alliance if you don't know what the major ally is going to do, whether it's providing assistance to Ukraine or providing troops for European security. So those that are should not be fired are those that are taking this as a, you know, maybe they'll drink a glass of champagne for a minute, but then they've got to go back into the bunker and try to figure out. So where do we go when we just don't know what the United States is going to do? And that's what the Macron speech is all about. Right. And in a lot of ways, I just got the transcript for it right before I had to go on stage. But from what I've been able to pick up from you all, as well as from the media, is he has said the right things. Generally, he has and he's saying the right things for the moment in terms of Europe has got to be able to hedge at a minimum in terms of what the U.S. may or may not do in the coming years. But importantly, Vago, is this: some of the prescriptions that he has laid out and the tone that he used, some of his rhetoric, is going to hit Washington wrong. He was talking about not being Washington's lapdog, and he said some other things that are just going to cause the antibodies to rise up in Washington, and people will miss the point of his speech. The point of his speech was to an audience of the elite here in not just in Paris, but across the EU, saying what you just did, which is, the EU has got to be more like a geopolitical power. We've got to have this third way. We've got to deal with China and compete with China and with the United States. And he was talking about what Fareed Zakaria was talking about in Foreign Affairs, and I'm sure he said at other places, that the U.S. hasn't necessarily been obeying some of the rules about trade. And a lot of what Macron was talking about is, the U.S. and China are not playing by the rules in economics, and therefore the EU shouldn't either. That we're in a new place, we should be competitive, and we should protect the defense industry and other vital industries, just the way the U.S. is doing with subsidies, et cetera, et cetera. On that point, I'm going to say this to the foreign ministry today: is I don't think a trade war is the answer. I don't think. Right. Some of the legislation coming out of the Congress was protectionist. It was, and subsidies and this kind of thing. But we're supposed to be engaging in discussions with Europe and with the EU on this, so that we can lessen the blow. But I think if Europe were to say, U.S., you know, screw you, we're going to raise tariffs and we're going to do all these other things, that's the wrong approach. And I'm going to be saying that, and say that while the cause is right, the prescription is wrong, and we've got to figure together a better way of dealing with that. Bottom line, though, Vago, was this: for God's sake, in Washington, please don't rise to the bait on the rhetoric. Please don't do that. Instead, listen to what he wants Europe to do and be glad for that, because we don't want Europe dependent on the United States militarily. We got to break the dependency, because we've shown that whether it's politically or because we're overstretched and because of China, Indo-Pacific, that Europe has got to be able to fill the gaps if they should appear because Trump's elected or whatever it might be. This is how they're going to do it. And if we just throw rocks at them and talk about freedom fries, then we're just, you know, we should all be fired in Washington. So that's what I'll say. Please, my bottom line, please don't rise their rhetoric. Listen to what he's saying and see if we can support the Europeans developing not strategic autonomy per se, but they've got to be able to stand on their own 2 feet. And we've got to work out this trade problem too. Okay, that's my speech.
Excellent. Well done. And I'm sorry for getting wrong your departure. I thought you had arrived back on our sunny shores, Jim. France's loss. Although I have to say, right, if you're a Jupiterian prime minister, you will even in have a greater focus on Charles de Gaulle, right? And that de Gaullist attitude that I think sometimes he channels. I think it's unfortunate because he regularly says the right thing. He's regularly focused on the right problem. He just has sort of a ham-fisted way of doing it that might appear to appeal to, and there is a quarter of this, right? I mean, we both have very dear French friends who have this sort of, I don't want to say resentment, but constant criticism of the United States and seeing everything as, oh my God, you know, you guys are spending on energy. We will not be your energy vassal, as opposed to saying almost every technology the United States invests and develops, whether it's wind or anything else, sometimes does come from Europe, and then Europe ends up benefiting from it. So would you rather Europe benefit from American investment or Chinese investment, right? I mean, it's, I think, should be pretty clear, because both of these are not equal. I'm going to come back to you in just a second, but Patrick, I want to get your sense, right? Does this interfere with the Chinese narrative at all about, you know, U.S. disengagement? You see, they can't be trusted. This is quite a lot of money the United States has made available to its allies and partners around the world. And I know that they're particularly irritated about, you know, it's not a lot of money, but it's $2 billion plus another $6 billion. That's for regional capabilities, submarine industrial base, right, that are all aimed directly at China on top of a defense budget that is increasingly focused on China. What are some of the messages that folks in the region took away from this, from your standpoint, including Beijing?
Well, there are important implications for allied political will, risk or risk aversion, and modern war. So the political will issue is that America does have bipartisan support to stay engaged. That's a good sign of political will. And yet at the same time, as we head toward the Washington NATO summit in July, there's no appetite inside the administration or probably in the American body politic overall to talk about Ukrainian accession into NATO, for instance, which is what Ukraine clearly would want, some kind of statement that they would begin exploratory talks or something. And I think that line is not lost on the Chinese, who are thinking about any change on America's one China policy in Taiwan. That is, what is the level of political will and the level of risk that the United States is willing to accept in defense of others who are being pressed by either Russia or China? And I think that's where there are a lot of lessons to be learned. Now, the ATACMS missiles going in, on the one hand, that shows that the Americans are not as risk averse as they seem to have been all this time. And yet, as Dove pointed out, I mean, that incrementalism is also a message in reverse, which is saying, no, we are risk averse. We only go with incrementalism, and you can exploit that. Now, the flip side of that is that the administration would say, well, it's not just risk aversion. It's also about maintaining allied unity. And that unity is a message back to China, because they fear anti-China coalitions sort of grouping together and holding and cohering. And so that is still a balancing act between, you know, not wanting to be incremental, but wanting to preserve unity. And finally, on the question of modern war, you know, it's what's happening on the battlefield in Ukraine. It's also what's happening between Israel and Iran. Those are lessons that the Chinese are studying, and it's changing, literally changing China. Xi Jinping just reorganized the strategic support force. I'd love to talk about that more. But the point is that is something that is information dominance and electronic warfare and cyberspace. These things are really at the core of modern war. So the narrative discussion about who's supporting whom and where we're going with this war and what are the end goals, and how much risk you're willing to take. These are critical issues that China's watching. And the part of the bill, the $8 billion that went to the Indo-Pacific, including Taiwan, Taiwan's satisfied with that. It'll help them with HIMARS and F-16 right. parts and so on. But it's not, it's only less than 10% of the overall bill. So it also tells you that, China's the pacing threat, but we're still very much having to fight conflicts right now in Europe and in the Middle East.
I'm going to go back to you, Jim, in a moment, but I just, something sort of jumps out it was, the administration wasn't sure how the Russians were going to respond. Now, after 2 years of war, they have a better sense that the Russians are not really going to do anything. And so that then, operates as part of the calculus. And again, anybody who knows Joe Biden, right, have consensus, bring everybody along, everybody sees what the problem is, it becomes a little bit easier than necessarily, even if the United States did provide a lot of that initial leadership, and we did so with the Brits and all of our allies and partners, right, to sort of advance the debate. But I agree that we were a little bit too timid earlier. On the other hand, as the great Chris Cervello on our show and as our sort of editorial strategist, noted, at the end of the day, he's the president of the United States and has got to be responsible if, God forbid, the Russians go ahead and do something because of one of his actions. So, completely disregarding it is maybe easier, much easier now to do than it was maybe earlier in this conflict. Jim, let me go back to you about what is really a stunning revelation, and kudos to Czech intelligence on this. Now backed up by other allies and partners, and the actions the Belgians have taken. The Belgian prime minister deserves quite a lot of credit as well for this, for the revelation that Russia has compromised entirely too many European parliamentarians. There was, always a suspicion, well, so-and-so has got to be in Russia's pocket. Now they're being evidence of actually having direct links to Russian intelligence. And then also people may not have thought had links to Russian intelligence, which is even more problematic, right? And then we have an incredible bust, the latest ones on German intelligence, no slouches either, by the way, no pun intended, that have been unmasking one Russian ring after another, and now a Chinese ring that was affiliated and designed to sort of boost ADF messaging. One of the points I like to make to everybody in terms of the fanning of anti-Semitic flames, migration flames, pro-Palestinian flames, there are a lot of Russian and Chinese fingers in that debate that is exacerbating everything in the United States. And I think we tend to be a little bit blind to that. It's not just stupid college students that are, anti-Semitic or, anti-Palestinian or what have you. There are other fingers that are involved in this. Jim, talk to us a little bit about how this changes the European dynamic, European politics. Because this is sort of, isn't this the latest sort of realization that in many respects, Russia is at war with Europe and the West? It just looks different in how they're waging that war, because you could argue, seeing what's happening on campuses here, what's happening among governments there, it's looking at this war very differently, and it's making unfortunate progress, and we're still too flat-footed about it.
Well, I would say that it's not a revelation to Europe. You talk to lots of Europeans, particularly from the Nordic Baltic area, and they'll say, yes, we've been at war for a couple of years now, the gray zone war, not just the misinformation, disinformation, and fiddling with their elections and that type of thing, but, GPS spoofing and cyber events. I mean, there's all kinds of things that Putin does that bullies a lot of these countries. And so the spying thing is something that the only thing that's new is that they're talking about it publicly. And we're hearing about it here in the U.S. And so it's one of these situations where it's new to us, maybe, but it's not new to them, and probably not new to our intel agencies either. And another thing, too, is I think if we did a sweep through the U.S. Congress, whether they know it or not, they certainly have fallen into the same bed with the Russians, too. A lot of these extremist Republicans coming out of the House are mouthing things that sound like they're written in Moscow. Now, I'm not saying that they knew that and they're doing this on purpose and they're getting paid off. But But certainly the Russians have been very good to put down talking points and things like that, that one way or another end up with a congressman or woman who sits there and says these things. So we're pretty susceptible too. And I think but it does go to show that in terms of how you combat that, I know the Europeans are miles ahead of us, particularly the Nordic countries, in terms of trying to educate their citizens and everyone else about this danger and don't fall to it. And I know they've been working with their parliamentarians as well. I don't know if we do that or not. I doubt it. And even if we did, I'm not sure there's anyone on Capitol Hill who really listens to that. So I think to all of us in the media or in other parts of the civil society in Washington, we have got to be aware of that and call it out when we see it and make sure that it's widespread, that this is infiltrating in to the U.S. into the U.S. conversation as well. And Europe is who we can point to and say, look what's happening to them. But at least they're calling it out. And at least they're trying to do something about it. We have to do something about it, too.
We are boiling it down to simplistic tropes that we're trying to use for political reasons, whether it's Israel or Palestine or anything. Everybody's trying to score points on it as opposed to getting more fundamental to that message. And border is the same thing as we just discussed in a number of other questions. Dove, let me briefly, Patrick, if you'll be just patient, because we do have a lot of Asia news, but I want to quickly, Dove, get your sense, and Michael, get your sense, right? Because we finally had members of Congress who are calling out, right? I mean, it's Moscow Marjorie. But unfortunately, the man who's running for president is oddly either beholden in the thrall of the useful idiot of, I hate to say that, of the Russian leader and the Russian leadership and the messaging that's coming at him, whether it's through Viktor Orban, which is a recycled Russian message, which is then, it has a gravitational force when so many people are misleading the public as if Russia's not that bad. Right. I mean, the focus is the border. You know, Vladimir Putin's not coming over the border. Well, but the Chinese are coming over the border, and it's about banning TikTok. This is a lot more complicated than banning TikTok. Dove, your sense, and then Michael, yours, and then Patrick, want to get your take on this as well.
First, let me underscore what Jim said. The Scandinavians, in particular, I remember the previous defense minister of Sweden telling me that one of the senior staffers on the Swedish Democrats was effectively a Russian agent. Swedish Democrats are the extreme right wing, who would write columns under a variety of pseudonyms, all obviously spouting the Moscow line, and they outed him. And so what the Europeans have just done is exactly right. We've tried it to some extent. Let's be clear about that. Mike Turner, in particular, said that Congress is being infected by the pro-Moscow line. Turner has been very active in the NATO Parliamentarians Conference, Assembly, I should say, very much committed to NATO, and of course, chairman of the Intelligence Committee. Mike McCall, who chairs Foreign Affairs, has pretty much said the same thing. But it hasn't had the same impact. I think Jim is right there. And it all comes down to what you said. It's the guy down in Mar-a-Lago. People have suspected for years that there's something going on between him and the Russians. Maybe it's just to build hotels in Russia. Who knows? But it's obvious, and it's been obvious for years. And certainly once he said he believed Putin more than his own intelligence community, that he is, at a minimum, a useful idiot. And I would emphasize both parts of that phrase. But he does have this tremendous influence over a good number, maybe as many as 100 members of the House. And many of them simply will not want to cross him, just like they don't want to cross him on other issues. They're not going to want to cross him on Russia.
Interesting. Michael, your sense about whether or not anybody is really looking at this in a deeper, more textured way than, I mean, I have to tell you, if that had happened in the United States where a far right member was outed, I don't know if that even has any impact or whether that person wouldn't become a featured speaker somewhere and a star all their own for, they're just trying to silence me, right? I mean, that's a great trope to use. Michael?
Yeah, look, I think your earlier point was right when you said that there are other fingers involved in this. You know, Russia and China are actively trying to undermine our democracy. And you have, and we've talked about this in previous shows, that the right, many on the right, have fallen victim to that. They're repeating Putin's propaganda. We've seen it not only with the president himself, but with, you know, media people like Tucker Carlson. Of course, we have Moscow Marjorie now, but now we also have it infecting the left as well.
And we have. They've just been doing it cleverly and differently so that the fingerprints are not as obvious.
Right.
I mean, the brilliance of this is brilliant.
Exactly. But now you have, you know, students at universities in the United States openly supporting groups that have killed hundreds of U.S. service members, right? I mean, you see the Hezbollah flag now at these Princeton protests. Who's supplying this stuff? Where are they even getting these Hezbollah flags? You cannot, you know, call these protests peaceful anymore. I mean, just yesterday, one of the universities had signs that said, you know, from the river to the sea. We know what that means. Another university was holding up signs that said final solution. At Columbia, one of the organizers of the Columbia protest posted a video saying Zionists do not deserve to live. And yesterday, Ilhan Omar posted, I had the honor of seeing the Columbia University anti-war encampment firsthand, and I'm awe of their bravery and courage. So just as the Putin propaganda
That's not as bad as the other ones are, but I take your point.
We can argue that one separately. I think she's a hateful anti-Semitic person, and you know she's encouraging this hatred on that campus, right? And also these students, which now Biden wants to forgive their student loans, but that's a second, you know, another story. I mean, we're all there, you know, camping out. Oh, woe is us. You know, they're all getting their degrees in victimhood. How can we expect it to be going to class when all these terrible things are happening? You know, and it's a bunch of nonsense. They don't even understand what they're protesting. You know, we see news organizations asking these kids questions because they have no idea why they're even out there. And again, they're being influenced by, I think, our adversaries to push them in this direction. And we even see people on these college campuses are not even students. Coming out in favor of this, and this is something that is going to rip is really hurting the Democratic Party, because you see, you know, many congressmen, actually we had several congressmen Gottheimer, Goldman, and Moskowitz, and Manning went to Columbia University this week, Democrats, and then you saw Mike Johnson go to the university and also get booed there, and then you have, you know, progressives like Richie Torres, who actually left the Progressive Caucus over this issue, who, you know, represents the Bronx. Is receiving racist messages all the time for his stance with Israel. He just posted yesterday his latest one that he just got, just as an example, you know, stupid N-word, you support effing Jews, right? So, you know, now we see how much hatred there is on the left that our enemies are exploiting, just like there is on the right.
I think somebody should really be taking people aside. If you want to make a pro-Palestinian and say, look, the Palestinians have gotten short shrift, and do it in a respectful manner. You don't turn it. You can, you know, Dove is critical of Israel regularly and of the Netanyahu government. You can do it respectfully without cartwheeling into anti-Semitism. And oh, by the way, saying we are Hamas is never a good message. I mean, if I can act as everybody's unofficial public affairs advisor on this, not a good way to curry favor with any audience, right?
You could say the Palestinians are getting short shrift, but they're getting short shrift from their own leadership, right? Well, the Palestinians have been offered their own state five times. And said no. Hamas is the one that got them in the mess. The Palestinians.
I understand, but there are a lot of people in this administration. I understand.
You can't put all the blame at Israel's feet on the Palestinian people receiving short shrift.
I am not all putting all the blame. I'm just saying it is a confluence of folks who don't really want to resolve it, and people are getting stuck in the middle. And that's my criticism. There are people also in Jerusalem who haven't wanted a deal either. Go ahead, Dove.
I was just going to say this. I would point a finger at a lot of the university administrators. I was in Columbia in 68 when they had the riots then, and the police were much less soft on people than they are now. They beat the you know what out of many students. But I just got a letter from the dean of Columbia, one of the deans, who was writing to alumni, and he basically said, we're not going to take sides in this. There's anti-Semitism and Islamophobia on campus, and we're going to try to do something about it. Well, the University Senate was going to condemn the president of Colombia for calling in the police, and they realized that that's not going to look terribly good. 150 Columbia professors have come out in support of the students on South Lawn. And the fact of the matter is that it's not a matter of Islamophobia. I haven't seen many tents in Colombia that are out there to demonstrate against Muslims or Muslim students. I haven't seen anybody saying kill all the Palestinians on campus. What you're seeing is what Mike described. And what's going on with the university, with Columbia's leadership, is going on in a lot of other universities. And because the university leaderships are not doing what they should be doing, which essentially is to prosecute one or two kids, which will stop this thing in its tracks. That's what Columbia did, by the way, in 1969, a year after the riots, when they wanted to try it again. But that forces the president to call in police. And that's the last thing you want on a campus. So in effect, they're hiding behind the police because they won't do something themselves. That just radicalizes everybody even more. And by the way, it's going to hurt Democrats much more than Republicans. I agree totally with Mike on this.
I completely agree with you. And then you have the alienation of a whole bunch of young voters who they desperately need in order to win this, because it's going to be close run. And to your academic point, and I think, Michael, what I was trying to say is, any campus has got to be predicated on liberal Western values of discourse. And if you spent the last couple of decades making the case that we're going to make a safe space for discussion and for people to express themselves, you have to figure out how to teach people to respectfully disagree, as opposed to becoming a shouting mob. And then it's one shouting mob or another shouting mob. And then you find in a situation like this, it becomes kind of chaotic and absurdist, which I often feel campus protests tend to devolve into anyway, because it's young people. They're whole variety. You can be very passionate and highly misinformed about your views. Alas, I have to go to Patrick, who's been very patient. Patrick, if you want to weigh in on any student protest, you're more than welcome. But we also have an enormous amount of Indo-Pacific stuff to talk about. We have to talk about Israel briefly, and I want to get your guys' take on also the Supreme Court immunity debate, because senior, you know, friends of mine, senior officers and not that senior officers in the military have expressed serious reservations about giving anybody immunity. They don't feel they have complete immunity, and that nobody is above the Constitution. Ultimately, it's all about accountability, especially if you're acting in an unconstitutional manner when you were in office. We understand the composition of the court and how they might be voting on this. But Patrick, start us off. You know, Antony Blinken's the latest senior American official to go to Beijing. He was there, you know, hey, let's have dialogue. Don't help the Russians. And the Chinese did what they always did, which is say, well, your choice is either cooperation on our terms and you have to respect our red lines, or you're going to have confrontation, which I suppose is the same message. Anyway, take this any direction you want to go into and kind of give us a quick update on the region, because, you know, we had U.S.-Philippine exercises. The Chinese hosted a big naval delegation, right, underscoring their outreach as well regionally and beyond. Walk us through the sort of important things we may have been missing as we focus on campus protests here in the United States.
And just a couple of sentences on the campus protests. As universities are getting ready for commencements, and my wife, Audrey, is getting ready for her own commencement at Carnegie Mellon University, where there is a collaboratory against hatred that was formed after the Tree of Life synagogue atrocities in 2018 between the Carnegie Mellon University and University of Pittsburgh. And the whole message there is honoring victims of this kind of hatred, not by warning people about the dangers of inciting hatred. And that's sort of the message to those on campus who are going so far beyond peaceful protests, you know, looking for a ceasefire, to inciting hatred and anti-Semitism. And we have to get back to unity over stopping that kind of incitement. Back on Asia, then in China, and the you know, the vast things that are happening, Secretary of State Blinken successfully meeting Xi Jinping. That was not even a certainty until the last day. He spent hours as well with Wang Yi, the foreign minister. there was a discussion about this looks like a more stabilizing time for U.S.-China relations, and yet there are a lot of doubts about whether that stability is really stable, or is it really just stasis? Is it just, you know, we're now stable at an unstable situation? Because nobody is moving. China is warning us that we have to adopt the right position, the right line. We have to accede to their demands, in effect. And Biden, you know, the Biden administration, especially led here by Secretary Blinken, talking about, hey, if you, China, don't get on board with cracking down on your banks supporting the Russian war economy, we will. We'll take action. Now, I doubt he said specifically what sanctions he'll pass, but I think he did drop some warnings there. And the fears of overcapacity in the economy and not implementing the fentanyl agreements, those are also of great concern to the United States. But it's really this question of whether China and the United States are going to try to keep some equilibrium on this relationship this year during this election year, or whether this tips over into some new crisis, whether that's in the South China Sea, whether that's elsewhere, including even over dealing with Russia. And Putin announced this week, by the way, that he is going to Beijing to see Xi Jinping next month, which we knew he was likely to do, but he chose the time that Secretary of State Blinken was in Beijing to make that announcement, meaning, hey, Secretary Blinken, you think you've got Japan and your allies? Well, China has Russia, and we are standing against the American-led system. So there's this overall competition that is surrounding these discussions, even though the discussions themselves were more civil than a year ago. There was no tangible progress, but the fact that there wasn't more open bickering is a kind of progress, if you will, on this relationship. Blinken did have a chorus of people behind him. I mean, I was hosting Deputy Secretary of State Kurt Campbell at Hudson. We invite you to watch that video. Great conversation about the strength of the U.S.-Japan alliance. He recommends Prime Minister Kishida and President Yoon of South Korea for a Nobel Prize. Meanwhile, you had PAC Fleet Commander at Western Pacific Naval Symposium in Qingdao, where you had the Chinese vice chairman of the Central Military Commission warning against maritime containment, that this would somehow unleash a vortex of turbulence. Those are his words. And that you had Admiral Aquilino, outgoing Indo-PACOM commander, one more week in the job in Japan, saying very clearly that the argument that China is only spending 7.2% on defense is wrong. It's drastically higher than that. And this is a man who ought to know. And so there were some very strong messages going on behind the scene to kind of prop up the U.S. position. And the same thing had been happening in China, with a whole bevy of arguments coming out of the foreign ministry and out of the state media that the United States needed, again, to get on with the correct message and was in danger of tipping across into conflict over Taiwan, or pushing AUKUS, or pushing the U.S.-Japan alliance in ways that were very dangerous. So that's the Secretary Blinken visit, and we'll see what happens from here. Other issues, including the South China Sea, the Balakatan exercise goes on, and one of the interesting new entrants there is the French. The French have sent a frigate. It's been operating this week with the Filipinos and the Americans, which we know that the French are a great Pacific presence and power, but they have not been directly involved in this exercise until now. We also see that there is a nuclear backdrop to everything that's going on as well. The Chinese aired a video while Secretary Blinken was in China of the new JL-2 submarine-launched ballistic missile, which was a reminder not only that China had a second strike nuclear capability, but that they were moving away with great celerity from minimal deterrence to a warfighting posture. And that message is the same thing that's resonating on the Ukrainian battlefield with Putin's threats. And we talked about the risk aversion and the fear of escalation. It's not without some basis, because Putin has been trying to strike Ukrainian nuclear power plants and has been threatening tactical nuclear weapon use. And in North Korea, Kim Jong-un overseeing a nuclear trigger drill. So this is literally a super large multiple launch rocket system where he is simulating a switch from conventional to tactical nuclear use. And so in all of these instances, China, Russia, and North Korea, and you could add Iran in there in terms of what they're doing. In fact, there was a North Korean technical delegation in Iran this week. That there's a, you know, an attempt to try to use nuclear threats and possible potential nuclear use, perhaps at a very low level, but nonetheless cross that threshold, cross the nuclear taboo, in basically being overwhelming and surprising to knock out the Americans and their allies out of whatever contest we're talking about. So that's a backdrop to a lot of what is happening here right now in the fear of escalation. And meanwhile, finally, President Biden signed the TikTok bill
right
on Wednesday. Nothing is likely to happen right now other than a lot of lawyers are going to get involved, and there will be quite a legal and political fight on whether you can divestment, whether you can force the divestment of TikTok from its parent organization. We'll see what happens with that, but I don't expect anything to happen quickly.
We have to go into a little bit of a lightning round, and I'm sorry about this in part because there's so much news on Israel. Dov, you know, walk us through. We've got, you know, Israel conducted a very targeted strike on Iran in response to Tehran's massive barrage against Israel the week before. The U.S. is leading the effort to build the causeway in Gaza. You know, Iran's proxies are shooting at Americans in the region, which is not good. Israel is stepping up its strikes in advance of its long-promised campaign in Rafah, where there's the last major concentration of Hamas leaders. Washington is saying we need to see a plan of a plan before the assault, and I'm not sure they've seen a plan yet. Washington has sanctioned an Israeli battalion, accusing them of using indiscriminate force against Palestinians, something which Bibi vows to fight. And then Israel's military intelligence chief resigned. Give us sort of the minute and a half version of where we are and where we're going and what all this means.
Well, actually, right, this probably the hostages have been front and center this week. The United States and 16 other countries signed or issued a call for the release of hostages in exchange for a ceasefire. Every one of those 16 countries had hostages: Serbia, Thailand, Britain, France, Denmark, and on and on. The Hamas people also released a video of a fellow that they thought, that people thought was dead, a man named Hirsch Goldberg Polan, who had lost his arm on October 7th. He's clearly alive. His parents, and particularly his mother, Rachel, have been leading the fight for the release of hostages, and she actually made Time's 100 Most Influential People this year. So there's that aspect. A mortar was actually fired at the causeway that's being built. Who knows who fired it? Was it Hamas? Was it Islamic Jihad? Was it some other actor? Again, we just don't know. But in any event, it's a sign that even when they're trying to bring food to the Palestinians, there are some Palestinians who would much rather that the war continue, even if their own people are dead. The Iraqi.
Well, indeed, that's at the heart of this, right? I mean, this could be done any other way, but unfortunately, the decision has been put. You know, 2.4, you know, 20 or 1,000 people have decided to put at risk 2.4 million people at the end of the day. And now that aid is coming, the people who are trying to bring the aid in are being shot at. I mean, it's kind of
they just don't care. One other aspect of the hostage thing, President Biden met with this 4-year-old little girl who had been a hostage as well. The prime minister of Iraq was in town, met with Biden, The very next day, Katib Hezbollah, which is another Iranian proxy operating out of Iraq, fired 5 rockets at a base in Syria from an Iraqi town named Zumar. And their argument was, well, look, you still haven't reached an agreement. I'm pulling out all American troops from Iraq. Well, who do you think wants that to happen? It's the Iranians, back to the Iranians. One of the biggest problems with the latest sanctions legislation, I would argue, and that legislation was part of The Mike Johnson package that passed and the president signed is, yes, there are sanctions now on shippers and refiners of Iranian crude and secondary sanctions that really are targeted against Chinese banks that support the purchase of Iranian oil. But you've got a 180-day waiver. And if you count the 180 days, guess what? You're at election day, which means that there'll be there probably will be waivers. And it should not be forgotten that Iran made $35 billion last year off its oil sales, thanks to the waivers that the administration, Biden administration had granted. And that's enough to finance all their proxies for the next 5, 6, or 7 years. So there's a total inconsistency there, which, by the way, Tehran fully understands, as do many others. And the reason we don't want to impose sanctions on or really impose them is because the price of oil is going to go up and the price of the pump will go up. And again, we go back to an election. So, you know, we've faced the Iranians here. The Iranians are still supplying the Ukrainians. North Koreans are supplying the Ukrainians. The Russians and the Chinese are working with the Iranians. The Chinese, which at one time were pretty very, very close to the Israelis, have inched away from them. I think Patrick will confirm that. Working more closely with Iran. So this group of four really is an alliance, is a de facto alliance against the United States. It's not a NATO agreement. It's nothing like that. But it is, they have one common enemy. And unfortunately, that has not really sunk in Washington. We still think of them as four individual problems as opposed to one massive problem. And we better change our thinking on that.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree with you more on that, Dov. Very quickly, in 30 seconds, Michael, I'm going to give you this question because you straddle, you know, the Hill, have worked in the Pentagon, and you're a lawyer. The Supreme Court is looking at whether or not President Trump can have immunity, whether limited immunity or complete immunity from prosecution for decisions that he made in office. You know, Trump is trying to stall this so the case doesn't come up. And unfortunately, we have a highly politicized court. There's no other really way to look at it that seems very amenable, frankly, to granting him immunity on one level or another, even if the actions that he took on January 6th was clearly beyond the purview and would be, you know, in many ways unconstitutional. But the argument is the president of the United States can order an assassination. He cannot be prosecuted for that as long as he does that assassination. Now, there are senior military leaders and retired senior military leaders who think that is highly problematic because at the end of the day, everybody is held accountable. Very briefly, what's at stake here, Dov, if you want to weigh in, but we're very long on this show because we've tried to cover a lot. Just give us a quick sense on what's at stake here, because it's far, that would suggest there's actually one person, right? If the Constitution wanted to have given him immunity, they would have. They didn't.
I agree, right? And it seems to me that the court is deciding things that are beyond the scope of the case that's in front of them, whether Trump has immunity from these specific claims. So look, I can't imagine that the court would grant a blanket immunity, but what seems is possible from the questions that we see is that the court may come up with some kind of test, which is a court has done in the past. For example, you know, when it looks at rights under the Constitution, whether they're, you know, fundamental right or not, something like that has to pass what's called the strict scrutiny test. And then if it's not a fundamental right, there are different tests that the court has laid out over the years. So it's possible the court comes up with some kind of test, which may or may not give him an out on some of his behavior. And I hope not. But definitely the questioning was concerning yesterday. But in the end, I just can't imagine that he would get blanket immunity because it would not bode well for leaders in the future.
I also think that they could just punt. He wins the election, he drops it, and I think they know that. They can read polls as well as anybody can. Go ahead, Dov, and then we got to end it. Go ahead.
Yeah, the problem for the military is very obvious. The Uniform Code of Military Justice makes it clear that you're supposed to resist an illegal order. And if Trump wins, then there's no such thing as an illegal order, even though it's an illegal order. That puts the military in an impossible position. And that's why I think so many of them are deeply concerned about how this plays out.
Thanks very much, gentlemen. Absolutely fantastic conversation. As always, hope you guys have a terrific weekend, terrific holiday. Thanks very much for joining us. We'll be back again on Sunday with the Business Roundtable. Until then, hope everybody has a great weekend, and we'll see you again soon. Take care.